Nick headed into the room he and Ford were sharing. Esme's door was closed, and I didn't hear any sound from within. I knocked softly. Esme, are you awake? I opened the door slowly and peered into the room. The drapes were drawn, and the room was so dark I could just make out Esme lying in bed. Hey, I'm sorry to wake you up, but it's late, and we're all going to lunch. I brought you some coffee. I spoke loudly, but there wasn't a response. I flipped the switch on the wall, flooding the room with light. Esme? And then, finally, I saw her. I dropped the coffee mug and screamed, and Nick came running out of his room, a towel wrapped around his waist. What is it? He shouted. What's wrong? Esme. I covered my mouth with my hands, shaking my head from side to side. Only then did Nick turn and look at his sister. What the? He gasped. Oh my God. I turned to him. I think she's dead. Chapter 6. Esme was dead. I repeated these words to myself over and over, but the reality wouldn't sink in. The rest of us gathered downstairs in the living room. Someone, John, I think, had called the police. As we waited for them to arrive, I was curled up on the couch, trying to process what was happening. John was sitting hunched forward in a chair, his elbows braced against his knees, staring blankly out at the water. Nick and Ford were in the kitchen. Nick had been crying, but Ford had managed to calm him down, rubbing his arm and talking in a low, soothing voice. Esme's body still lay upstairs. Her eyes were open and staring. Her mouth was agape, as though she'd died gasping in her final breath. Her skin was already cold to the touch. I shuddered and closed my eyes, willing the image away. Just yesterday, mere hours ago, I'd thought Esme had never looked happier, never shone brighter, and now she was gone. Do any of you have any illegal drugs or anything else you would want the police to find? I looked up, startled at Ford's question. No, I said. Why? Well, they're going to search the house. Why would they do that? John asked. Ford looked at him incredulously. An otherwise healthy woman died for an unknown reason. I'm sure the police are going to treat Esme's death as suspicious unless proven otherwise. Caroline and I don't take drugs, John said, sounding weary. Is it possible that Esme might have? Ford asked. All three men looked at me. I shook my head. I mean, she'd smoked pot a few times in college, but that's it as far as I know, although... What? Nick asked sharply. She's had a hard time sleeping since the divorce. I think her doctor prescribed her sleeping pills, but those wouldn't be illegal. Ford nodded. No, but sleeping pills combined with how much she had to drink could be a dangerous combination. He glanced at Nick. That could be the cause of death. Nick shook his head, like he wanted it all to go away. There was suddenly a loud banging on the front door. That must be the police. John stood stiffly and headed downstairs to let them in. Get ready, Ford said softly. I glanced at him, wondering what he meant. Ford didn't elaborate, but it quickly became clear. In seconds, the vacation house seemed to be filled with EMTs and police officers, even though there couldn't have been more than half a dozen of them. It felt like an invasion of uniformed people. John directed the EMTs to Esme's room and then returned downstairs with one of the uniformed officers. I'm Officer Grant. He looked young, not much older than Aiden. His expression was stern and direct. This is a camera here on my vest and I'll be recording this. He pointed to his chest. Do you all understand? The four of us glanced at one another and then nodded. Please, one at a time, tell me your names. When it was Nick's turn, he said, "I'm Nick Overfield, the brother of the..." Nick trailed off, trying to find the words for this surreal situation. "I'm Esme's brother." Nick stepped forward and held his hand out, but the officer didn't shake it. In that moment, I realized Ford was right. The police were treating us with suspicion, at least for the time being. "Esme is the victim?" the officer confirmed. "Victim?" Nick's face scrunched up in confusion. "Why are you calling her a victim?" The officer didn't answer his question. "What's Esme's last name?" "Lamont," Nick replied. "It was her married name, but she just got divorced and was planning to change it back to Overfield." Nick was babbling. Was it nerves, I wondered, or was he in shock? "And you folks are all staying here together?" "Yes," John said. "It's a vacation rental. We arrived yesterday and we're supposed to be here for the week." "Do any of you know how Mrs. Lamont died?" "We have no idea," John said. "We were all up pretty late last night, so we assumed Esme was sleeping in, but eventually, Caroline," John gestured in my direction, "went to check on Esme, and that's when we discovered she'd..." He stopped and swallowed. "Died." "A late night," Officer Grant repeated. "What kept you up so late?" "We had dinner here," Nick said, "and then we just stayed up talking and listening to music." "Has anyone else been here in the house since you arrived in town?" "No, it was just the five of us," John said. "No guests? Not even the person you rented the house from?" "No," I said. "There was a lockbox by the door downstairs that held the house keys. They gave us a code for it. Esme was the first one here, so she was the one who got the keys." "So Mrs. Lamont was alone in the house before the rest of you arrived? Was there any chance she met with someone then, or later in the evening?" I shook my head. "John and I arrived just a few minutes after Esme, and then we were all together for most of the night," I said, "right up until we went to bed. Esme was the first to turn in, and she was hardly in any state to meet anyone at that point," Nick added. Officer Grant turned to him. "Why do you say that? Had she taken any drugs? Consumed alcohol?" The four of us shifted uneasily and looked at one another, waiting to see who would speak. I immediately knew the optics of this were terrible, and Ford seemed to sense that too. "Esme had quite a bit to drink last night. She was visibly intoxicated," Ford said. "Nick and I had to help her upstairs to her room." "What happened then?" "She got into bed." Nick reminded her to check her blood level. "Esme's had type 1 diabetes since she was a kid. We were concerned that the wine could affect her glucose levels," Nick chimed in. "And?" "I got her testing kit from her toiletry bag. She has a device that pricks her finger and then reads her blood sugar level. It was a little high, so she injected some insulin." "Where did she inject it?" the officer interrupted. "Into her upper left arm." Nick pointed to his bicep to illustrate. "She didn't need help?" "No, like I said, she's had diabetes since she was like 12. 13, I said, interrupting. "She'd been diagnosed the same year she'd gotten her first period." I knew the map of Esme's life almost as well as I knew my own. It had been imprinted on me through all of the late nights we'd sat up talking, all of the long walks we'd taken, all of the traumas we'd been through together. I'd never have a friend like her again, one whose history was so intertwined with my own. The pain of this realization pricked through the cloud of shock and grief. I wrapped my arms around myself, trying to ward it off. Right, Nick said. She was used to injecting herself, and to be honest, I've never been good with needles. He shuddered. I remember when we were kids, my mom tried to teach me how to inject her in case I ever had to. She had me practice by injecting oranges. I couldn't even do that. It grossed me out. He looked up and saw all of us watching while he rambled on. Sorry, I'm just... sorry. Sir, I just need the details of what happened last night, Officer Grant said. Okay, right. Like I said, she injected her insulin and I put the kit back in her bathroom. She was asleep by the time I came out. He looked at Ford. She was already asleep, right? Yes, Ford said. And you were both there when this happened? Officer Grant looked at Ford. Ford nodded. Nick closed the drapes in her room and I turned off her lights, then we went back downstairs. So as far as you know, she didn't consume anything else? Could she have brought any additional medications on the trip? I'm pretty sure she has a prescription for sleeping pills, I said. But I have no idea if she took one last night or if she even brought them with her. The officer nodded and then looked over his shoulder as the EMTs clattered down the stairs. He went to consult with them. Although they all kept their voices low, I could hear snippets of their conversation. Couldn't resuscitate. Medical examiner. Detectives. Officer Grant finally came back to the four of us. Do any of you need anything from the rooms upstairs? We all shook our heads, mute at the horror of the situation. Good. Please stay downstairs till we're done processing. They're not taking Esme? John asked, nodding at the EMTs. No, not until the detectives and the medical examiner clear the scene. Sit tight. It's going to be a while. Chapter 7. A while ended up meaning nearly 3 hours. More police officers arrived, including a pair of detectives in suits and a team that included a medical examiner and crime scene technicians. John, Nick, Ford, and I had decamped to the back deck, both to escape the chaos and to have some modicum of privacy. Officer Grant was watching us through the French doors, probably to make sure we didn't run off. It made me feel oddly panicked and claustrophobic. Why did they bring in crime scene techs? Nick whispered. I told you. They're going to treat this as a crime until proven otherwise, Ford replied. They can't possibly do that every time someone dies in their sleep. Esme was only 49, and she was in good health, I said. Except she wasn't. She was diabetic, John said dully. Look, it's pretty obvious what happened, isn't it? What are you talking about? I asked. She was drunk last night, really drunk. She must have misjudged how much insulin she needed and injected too much. I don't think so, Nick said. It didn't look like she wasn't injecting an abnormal amount. You were drunk too, Ford said. Nick turned to him looking like a puppy whose owner had just kicked him. Are you saying this is my fault? No, of course not, Ford said. If she did overdose on insulin, it wouldn't be anyone's fault. Just a terrible accident. All I meant is that your memory might be a little hazy. Ford spoke to Nick softly, which seemed to calm him. In the past day I'd spent with them, I'd noticed that Ford quite often took on this role in their relationship. Then again, Nick's sister had just died. Maybe this was normal behavior in a healthy marriage? I glanced at John, who kept zoning out, staring at the ocean as though it held the answer to some puzzle. My best friend had just died, and my husband certainly wasn't going out of his way to soothe me. I could use a drink right now, Nick said. So have one, John said. Nick looked up hopefully. Will they let us? As far as we know, a crime hasn't been committed. No one is under arrest. This is our home, albeit a temporary one. John stood suddenly. I think we could all use a drink. I'm going to go get a bottle of wine. We waited like a group of teenagers about to get into trouble. But John marched off into the house and returned a few moments later with a bottle of chilled white wine and 4 glasses. He set the glasses down and poured a hefty amount into each one. Once we were each holding a drink, Nick raised his glass. To Esme, he said. My big sister. His eyes welled with tears. Christ, I wish I were more eloquent. I don't have the words to express how heartbroken I am. We had so many good times. And even through the bad times, she was always there for me. Someone I could always count on. The world is going to be a cold place without her in it. His words were emotional, but I couldn't help but wonder how heartfelt they really were. I knew a lot about Nick's relationship with his sister, and they'd never been especially close. Esme always tried to talk her father out of financing Nick's businesses and got frustrated when he ignored her advice. Nick's pet nickname for his sister was the Princess, always said with a poisonous hiss at the end. And then there was the argument I'd witnessed between the two of them at their father's 75th birthday party a few years earlier. I don't know what started it. Esme probably made a comment about Nick's professional failures, or maybe he needled her about being spoiled and self-centered. They were experts at pushing each other's buttons, but whoever started it, it escalated until Nick pushed Esme against the wall, one hand wrapped around her neck. He'd been pulled off of her almost immediately, but the attack had left a faint bruise. I was shocked by the incident. Was it possible his grief was genuine? Of course it was. But it was also possible that he was putting on a show for the rest of us. "To Esme," I said, raising my glass. "To Esme," Ford and John chimed in. We fell silent, drinking our wine. "Oh my God, look," Nick said, staring into the house. We all turned to look. Uniformed police officers were slowly bringing a stretcher down the staircase. Esme's body was strapped on top, zipped into a body bag. "Holy shit," John said, his voice low. Nick began to weep. "Oh my God. I have to call her father. What am I going to tell him?" Nick wrapped his arm around his husband's shoulders. I watched silently as my best friend's body was carried away and wondered how it was possible that any of this was really happening. Chapter 8. The police finished their search of the house. They took away bags of evidence, including our phones, laptops, tablets, and whatever other items they considered pertinent. I had never been glued to my phone, obsessively checking social media or email. But as soon as it was taken from me, I felt a keen sense of loss. What if Aiden needed to get a hold of me or a client? "Don't you need a warrant to take our personal belongings?" John asked Officer Grant. "We have one," Officer Grant replied. "I'll show it to you." He went to get the warrant, and John turned to me. How did they get a warrant so quickly? And on what basis? I shrugged, as confused as he was. Officer Grant returned and handed the document to John. His brow furrowed as he read it. "We're also going to take fingerprint samples." Officer Grant looked around at us. "From everyone." Nick was granted permission to use his phone for a few minutes to call his father. He went inside, clearly hoping to make it a private conversation, but Officer Grant followed after him. When Nick returned, he looked hollowed out, and his eyes were rimmed with red. But he had stopped crying. I couldn't imagine having to tell an 80-year-old man with terminal cancer that his beloved only daughter had died. Finally, late in the afternoon, after they'd collected our things and taken our fingerprints, one of the detectives came out onto the deck, where the four of us were still waiting. The others looked as tired as I felt, even though we'd spent most of the day sitting around. I suppose we were all emotionally exhausted. "I'm Detective Gavin Reddick. I understand you're all visiting from out of town." "Yes, Jacksonville and Miami. We have the house booked for the week," John confirmed, "but under the circumstances, I doubt we'll stay. You'll need to stick around until we get back the initial report from the medical examiner. It should only take a day or two," the detective replied. John bristled. "You can't make us stay here. We're not under arrest." "No," the detective agreed, "but this looks like a nice place. I think you'd be more comfortable waiting here than cooling your heels down at the station, but that's up to you." "That's ridiculous if we're not under arrest," John began, but I put my hand on his arm to stop him. John might technically be right, but we couldn't make it seem as if we had something to hide. The one thing we'd learned from Aiden's recent experience with the criminal justice system was that it moved slowly and rarely worked in the favor of someone accused of committing a crime. "He said it'll only be another day," I said. "It's not worth arguing about. We'd plan to be here anyway." "A day or two," the detective clarified, "but the medical examiner isn't backed up. It shouldn't take too long to get an initial report." He turned and joined his partner, who was waiting for him inside. We watched as the two of them disappeared down the stairs that led to the front door. The four of us were finally alone. "What now?" Nick asked. "Now we wait," Ford said. We never did get lunch. "Is anyone hungry?" We all shook our heads. My stomach felt sour and shrunken. Just the thought of food made me feel slightly sick. "I could use another drink," Nick said dully. "I'm going to go for a walk," I said. I wanted to be alone with my thoughts and my memories of Esme. I wasn't sure if I was ready to mourn her yet, but I felt an almost primal urge to be away from the place she died. As soon as I stepped towards the gate, John stood and said, "I'll go with you." "Fine." I couldn't think of an excuse to stop him from joining me. And, after all, I'd been irritated with him for not being more emotionally supportive. Now he was offering to join me on a walk, and I wanted nothing more than for him to leave me alone. I opened the gate and descended the flight of wooden stairs down to the beach. John followed behind me. When we got to the bottom, we both kicked off our shoes. The sand was warm and so soft, my feet sank into it with every step. "Let's go down to the water," I suggested. John nodded, and we headed towards the shoreline. The wet sand was easier to walk on, and the water lapping over my toes felt soothing. I glanced back to make sure I'd recognize the house when we returned, and was startled to see Nick and Ford standing at the deck railing, staring down at us. "They're watching us," I said. "Who?" "Nick and Ford." John glanced back. "That's not creepy or anything. So, what do you think?" "About which part?" I was so mentally fatigued, I didn't even try to make sense of his vague question. "Do you think they did it?" I stopped abruptly. "What?" "Nick and Ford. Do you think they killed Esme?" "Why on earth would you say that?" "Why do you think?" "They were the last ones to see her last night, and they certainly had a motive. Nick is now their father's sole heir." "That's crazy. Why would Nick do something like that? He's already set to inherit a lot of money, nearly $10 million, I think." Esme had rarely discussed her finances with me, but when I'd visited her in Miami over the summer, she'd started reminiscing about her father. "He's so sick, Caro," she'd said, swiping the tears in her eyes. "Every day he seems to get weaker. I'm trying to be strong for him, but it's so hard. Everyone thinks that getting an inheritance is like winning the lottery, but it is not. I don't care about the money. I just want my dad to get better." I'd held her hand while she sobbed. "Well, maybe he wants another $10 million, John now suggested. "Or maybe the new husband does." "I don't know." I shook my head. "I know Nick can be difficult, but I don't think he's evil. And that would be a crazy risk to take. If he was caught, he'd go to jail. And even if he wasn't prosecuted, if his father thought Nick was involved, he could simply disinherit him and give his money to someone else, to a charity or another relative." "I agree. It would be a gamble. But if they got away with it," John whistled, "that's a serious payday. And Nick has never seemed attached to Esme. When he was crying earlier, I couldn't help but think that he was faking it," I finished. John nodded. "Yes, I wondered about that too, actually. It did seem over the top, but that doesn't mean he or anyone else killed her. I still think Esme accidentally overdosed on her insulin. I know, John put his hands in his pockets, his shoulders slumping forward. The ocean breeze ruffled his fair hair. She certainly didn't seem depressed. I doubt she'd have done it on purpose. Oh my God, that didn't even occur to me. I'm sure it occurred to the police. No, Esme wasn't suicidal. She was so happy yesterday, happier than she's been in ages. I even thought, well, this is going to sound silly. What? I thought she was in love. She had that look about her. She was practically glowing. Was she? Esme said she's been seeing someone, but she didn't go into detail. You know what she's like. I swallowed. Was like. She could be intensely private. But anyway, no. It must have been an accident. A terrible, awful accident. Unless it wasn't, John persisted. The police obviously aren't convinced that she died of natural causes. I shook my head. I'm sure they're just following protocol. If they really are looking for potential suspects, they should probably focus on David. I nodded. The divorce had been acrimonious. Do you remember when I went to see Esme in June? Yes, of course. David came over one night. He was drunk, or at least I think he was. He sounded drunk. He was ranting and pounding on the door. I wanted to call the police, but Esme told me not to. She said he'd go away. Right. I remember you mentioning that. You said he scared you. Yes, but it wasn't so much that he was there pounding on the door. It was what he was yelling. What? He told Esme she was going to pay for leaving him. At the time, I thought he meant financially, but what if he was threatening to physically harm her? John nodded gravely. We need to tell the police. Chapter 9. When we got back to the rental house, Nick and Ford were no longer on the deck. I wondered how long they'd watch John and me walk down the beach, and whether they'd been talking about us as we had them. I had to assume they were. We let ourselves in through the French doors. Nick and Ford were in the kitchen. Nick was drinking what looked like scotch out of a lowball glass, while Ford stuck to sparkling water. We were thinking of ordering a pizza, Nick said. Food still held no appeal for me, and we had more pressing matters to attend to. Sure, whatever you like, but John and I were just talking, and we think we should let the police know just how contentious Esme's divorce was. Ford nodded, understanding at once what I was saying. Would Esme have had a chance to change her will after the divorce? Or would a will made prior to a divorce even still be valid? John countered. Wait. Nick put his hands up. Stop. What are you all talking about? We've been working on the assumption that Esme's death was either accidental or due to natural causes, I said, which is most likely the explanation. She could have injected too much insulin, or she could have had an aneurysm or a blood clot or something along those lines. But if it wasn't, who would hate Esme enough to kill her? John said, finishing my thought. David, Nick said immediately. He's the only person I know who hated Esme. He absolutely despised her, I agreed. He was furious she left him, even though they were miserable together. He's so narcissistic, I'm sure he couldn't bear the idea that she didn't want to be married to him anymore. And he could have driven up here in the middle of the night and been back in Miami without anyone even noticing he was gone, John added. But that's not possible, Ford said. We all turned to stare at him. He looked less careworn than the rest of us. He was clean-shaven and wearing a crisp white button-down shirt over khaki shorts. I hadn't showered since the day before, and I knew I looked disheveled in my oversized black t-shirt and capri yoga pants. Why? Because he didn't know Esme was here? Nick asked. David was a software developer. If he wanted to trace Esme through her phone or even by putting a tracker on her car, he'd have known how to do that, John pointed out. I don't doubt it. You don't have to be a computer whiz to track someone's whereabouts, Ford said. But he couldn't have been in the house last night. I set the alarm before we went to bed. And I turned it off when I got up this morning, I said, realization dawning. Did anyone turn it off and on again in the middle of the night? The three men shook their heads. But the alarm code is posted on the fridge where anyone could see it, Nick pointed at the sheet of paper. But Ford was already shaking his head again. Granted, that isn't exactly a secure place to keep an alarm code, and we can pretty much assume that anyone who's ever stayed here would know how to disarm it. But how would David have known that Esme was going on vacation, staying in this particular house, and then find out the alarm code ahead of time? It doesn't seem probable. What if Esme turned off the alarm? I suggested. She was really drunk, Nick said. She'd passed out by the time Ford and I left her room last night. But we can't rule out that she might have woken up and even gotten up at some point after that, John said. No, we can't, I agreed. We should still tell the police about David. I agree, John said. Nick sat down on one of the high stools by the counter and shook his head. I can't believe we're having this conversation. It's surreal. This whole day has been surreal. Do you know my dad started crying when I told him? I'm 42 years old, and I have never heard him cry before. Ford rubbed his shoulder. It's good that he heard the news from you, rather than someone else. I know. But it broke my heart. Nick started to weep again. John shot me a pointed look. I pretended not to see it. No one spoke much while we ate the pizza Nick had ordered. I didn't take more than a few bites. The cheese was oily and congealed, and it sat heavily in my stomach. I wasn't sure if everyone was simply emotionally drained from the day's sad events, or if there was a more ominous undertone to the silence. The fact that Esme's cause of death was still unknown. The creepy way Nick and Ford had watched John and me walk away down the beach, John's belief that they themselves could possibly be suspects. After we ate, Nick and Ford turned on the wall-mounted television to watch the news. John went outside to the deck without saying a word to anyone, including me. He slumped in one of the cushioned chairs and stared moodily out at the water. I left him to his brooding and went up to our room. I curled up in bed with my book. I expected that John would come upstairs and join me, but he never did come up, or at least not until long after I finally fell asleep, my book still clutched in my hands. Chapter 10. There was a loud banging on the front door at 9 o'clock the next morning. I was so startled, I spilled the cup of coffee I'd been holding down the front of my sundress. I yelped in pain. Are you okay? Ford looked concerned. I'm fine, I said, plucking the fabric away from my skin. The knocking continued. Bang, bang, bang. It was jarringly hostile. Who the hell is that? Nick wondered. John came downstairs from the third floor. It's the police, he said. They're back. I saw them pull up to the house through the upstairs window. I'll go let them in, Ford said, turning to the stairs that led down to the first floor. Ford returned a moment later, ushering the two detectives into the living room. One was Detective Reddick, who had spoken to us the previous day. He was accompanied by an older man who looked to be in his early 50s and who was heavy-set, with a ruddy complexion and thick, dark hair. We all stood up when they entered, as though we were in a courtroom and they were the judges. Good morning, Detective Reddick said. This is my partner, Detective Mike Monroe. Detective Monroe tipped his head in greeting but remained silent. Both detectives looked grim. We'd like to interview each of you. One at a time, Detective Monroe said. Why? Nick asked. Some new evidence has surfaced. We're now investigating the death of Esme Lamont as a homicide, Detective Reddick said. Nick sat back down abruptly, as if his legs had gone out from underneath him. He started shaking his head back and forth, but that's not possible. This had to have been an accident. And you said it would take a few days to get the autopsy report back. It should be back this afternoon, but we've collected other evidence that has determined the focus of our investigation, Detective Munro said. What evidence? John asked. That's not how this works, Detective Reddick said. We ask the questions. Shouldn't we have lawyers present? Nick asked. That's certainly your prerogative, Detective Munro said. He tipped his head to one side. Do you think you need a lawyer? No, of course not. Nick sounded defensive. Nick, if you want a lawyer, you should get one. John's lip curled as he glared at the detectives. Don't let them bully you. The police love to do that. I knew John was thinking about Aiden. Police had questioned Aiden for hours after his arrest without an attorney present and even offered a lesser sentence if he agreed to become a confidential informant for them. By the time he finally called John, Aiden had already confessed to purchasing the heroin. We're not here to bully anyone, Detective Reddick said. We're here to find out what happened to Mrs. Lamont. We were discussing it last night, and we think you should talk to her ex-husband, Nick said, David Lamont. He and Esme hated each other. Caroline, tell them what happened when you were visiting Esme last spring, when David showed up unannounced. Well, like Nick said, David appeared at Esme's house without warning. He was drunk, so she wouldn't let him in or even open the door. But I could clearly hear him yell that she was going to pay for what she'd done to him, I said. At the time, I thought he was talking about money. Esme was a lot wealthier than David, but now I'm not so sure. What if he meant he was planning to hurt her? We're confident that David Lamont wasn't involved in the death of his ex-wife, Detective Munro said. How can you say that? Nick asked. You don't know David. I have no doubt that he'd be capable of violence. I saw him hit Esme once. You did? I asked. She'd never told me about that. Nick nodded. They were arguing about something and he slapped her across the face. I told him if he ever touched my sister again, I'd... Nick stopped abruptly as if just remembering we weren't alone. He'd what? I wondered. What was Nick really capable of? Detective Reddick sighed, clearly annoyed that Nick wasn't following his rule about not asking questions. His partner was more forthcoming. 2 reasons. The first is that the security company who monitors the house alarm for this property told us that the alarm was turned on at 11:32 p.m. on Saturday, September 5th. It remained on until 7:03 a.m. on Sunday, September 6th. There are sensors on every door and window in the house, so we have proof that no one entered or exited the house between 11:32 p.m. and 7:03 a.m. Based on the statements you gave to Officer Grant yesterday, you were the only ones here during that time period, and the medical examiner's initial report puts Mrs. Lamont's time of death at somewhere between 12:30 and 1:15 a.m. on Sunday morning. Oh my God. Nick looked at Ford. We were right across the hallway when she died. We didn't hear a thing. I could feel John's eyes on me, but I didn't want to meet his gaze, not while the detectives were watching. Hold on. You said there were 2 reasons why David couldn't have killed Esme, I said. What was the second? Mr. Lamont was arrested by the Miami-Dade police on Saturday, September 5th at 7:24 p.m., Detective Reddick said. We all sat stunned into silence. David had been arrested? I marveled. For what? Nick asked. Detective Reddick glared at him. You don't seem to get the protocol here. We ask the questions, you answer them. Detective Munro held up a placating hand to his partner. It's a fair question. David Lamont was pulled over for a suspected DUI. He agreed to take a breathalyzer and blew a .17, which is well over the legal limit. Mr. Lamont was in police custody at the time Mrs. Lamont died. As far as alibis go, it's pretty airtight. So unless you have any other questions or need us to provide you with snacks or a note to your mommy to explain why you'll be home late from school, I think we should get started. Detective Reddick glanced around the living room. We'll do the interviews in here, one at a time. The rest of you can wait out on the deck. And if we refuse? John crossed his arms. That's your choice, Detective Monroe said. He was more pleasant than his partner. We'd like to try to keep this as informal and comfortable as possible, but if you'd prefer, we can take this down to the station. I knew my husband was right. We didn't have to cooperate. But I also knew how refusing to cooperate with the investigation would look. John, I put my hand on his arm to quell his protests. Come on. I'd rather talk to them here than at the police station. John frowned at me, but finally shrugged and turned away to stare out at the ocean. It seemed to be his favorite hobby lately. We'll start with Nick Overfield, Detective Reddick said. The rest of you can wait outside. Chapter 11. None of this makes any sense, John said as soon as we were out on the deck and out of earshot of the detectives. How can they investigate Esme's death as a homicide without even knowing how she died? It would be one thing if she'd been shot or strangled. I flinched. John saw me and looked contrite. I'm sorry, he said. I didn't mean to be grisly. I just don't understand where the detectives are coming from. How can they investigate a murder without any evidence that a murder took place? But there is evidence. Ford stood at the railing, looking out at the ocean. They said they found something, either on our phones or in their physical examination of the house. They wouldn't be here if they hadn't. Not necessarily. I sat on the cushioned love seat. It was exactly where Esme had been lounging that last night. I tried not to think about that. They could just be fishing, trying to scare us. The police aren't under any obligation to tell us the truth about anything. Right, but the truth is, I know why they're here. Ford turned around and leaned back against the railing. He crossed his arms over his chest. It's going to come out anyway, so I might as well tell you. My heart raced. Tell us what? I have a record, so I have no doubt that the police are focusing their investigation on me. A record? John repeated. What for? Ford sighed. Insurance fraud, forgery, theft by fraud, and that's not counting my juvenile record, which is supposed to be sealed, but which I'm sure these guys have access to. That sounds serious, I said. Have you been to prison? Yes, more than once. The first time I served an 18-month sentence. That was for insurance fraud. A friend who worked for an oncologist recruited me. He'd find patients that were relatively young who'd been diagnosed with aggressive forms of cancer. I'd take out life insurance policies on them, small enough that they wouldn't trigger a medical exam. Then, if the patient died, our plan was to collect on the policy. It was a pretty dumb scheme, all things considered. If you're going to scam someone, an insurance company is not a good target. They were onto us before we'd made the first claim. I'm sure that everything pinged. That we used the same post office box when we took out the policies. That we weren't related to the patients. But I was young and stupid. And you got older and smarter? John asked. Ford looked at him directly. Yes, I learned my lesson. And I learned not to get caught. And I didn't, for a while. But then, he sighed. I was involved with a project that prosecutors called a pyramid scheme. I won't go into all of the details, but my partners and I convinced people to invest in a series of concerts we were promoting. It was kind of a Floridian version of Coachella, complete with big-name musicians and celebrities. But the actual show never came together. The investors got angry and contacted law enforcement, who decided to pursue it as theft by fraud. That landed me in jail for about 3 years. But why did you do it? I asked. You had to know the risk. Money, Ford said simply. The investors were eager and stupid, and I was more than happy to take advantage of that. People were writing me 5 and even 6-figure checks just for the chance to be a part of something glamorous, to hobnob with celebrities. And I was overcharged, by the way. It's not a crime to plan an event that doesn't come together. Unless you knew it was a sham from the beginning, John pointed out. Who's to say I did? A jury, apparently. The case didn't go to trial. I took a plea deal in exchange for testifying against my partners. It seemed like a smart move at the time, but I'm sure as soon as those detectives found out about my past, they started making all sorts of assumptions. Ford jutted his chin towards the interior of the house. We had a clear view of the police questioning Nick. They're probably asking him all about it right this minute. We all turned to gaze inside at Nick, who was twisting around in his seat to look out at his husband. His expression was a mixture of shock and confusion. You never told him, I said quietly. No, Ford confirmed. I didn't. I'm not the same man now that I was then. I left that entire life behind before I ever met Nick, so there was no reason to tell him. And I suppose I thought that if I did, he'd suspect that I was only with him for his money. Aren't you? John asked, not bothering to hide his arch tone. As a matter of fact, I'm not. I love Nick. Very much. Not that I expect you or anyone else to believe that. I believe you, I said, surprised to realize that I meant it. I did believe him. Ford's lips twitched downward. The police won't. When Nick's interview was finished, he didn't join us on the deck. He went straight upstairs, and Ford watched him through the glass-paned French doors. Maybe I should go talk to him, he said. He didn't get the chance. Detective Reddick opened one of the French doors. Mr. Overfield, we have a few questions for you. I bet they do, John said softly. Ford nodded, looking resigned. He followed the detective inside. I told you he was shady, John said as soon as we were alone. You did. And yet you just said you believed him, that he didn't marry Nick for his money. I do believe him. John snorted with disbelief. He just admitted he's a con man who's gone to jail for scamming people. Marrying a rich guy was just another scam. You are always so black and white, I said, suddenly irritated by my husband's very presence. People can be more than one thing. Ford can have a checkered past and still be in love with Nick. Not if he's a sociopath. They don't have consciences and they're incapable of love. You don't know that he's a sociopath. You want to think he's a nice guy because he's good looking and charming, but that's what sociopaths do. They charm you. They seduce you. Ford is hardly going to seduce me. He's gay. It doesn't have to be sexual seduction. You've known him for 2 days and you're already on his side. What are you talking about? There aren't sides here. John stared at me. Of course there are sides. You heard the detectives. They think someone killed Esme, and they've narrowed it down to the 4 of us. It's either us or them. They don't even know how Esme died. Despite the warm day, I felt a sudden chill and rubbed at my arms. She was really drunk that night. She shouldn't have injected her own insulin. We should have helped her. Would you know how much insulin she needed? I shook my head. No idea. Even when we roomed together in college, she'd always inject herself when I wasn't around. I think she was self-conscious about it. I turned to watch the police questioning Ford. His back was to us, but I could tell from his posture that he was tense, defensive. Don't you think it's odd that they're questioning us all here at the house, practically right in front of each other? Oh, I think they're doing that on purpose, John said. But why? They want us to see each other's reactions. They wanted Ford to see that they had told Nick about his criminal record. The detectives obviously came in here with a game plan. John looked at me gravely. They're hoping they can play us off each other until one of us confesses. Chapter 12. By the time Detective Reddick next appeared at the glass-paned door, it felt like John and I had been waiting for hours. Maybe we had been. I didn't have a watch or my phone to clock the time. "Mr. Reed, please come inside," Detective Reddick said. The police were ready for their next target. Apparently, I would be the last one questioned today. John glanced at me. I knew he wanted to protest the summons, to refuse to submit to questioning. I shook my head. "Just go deal with it." John nodded and walked silently inside. I expected and hoped that Ford would go upstairs after Nick and I would be left alone on the deck. I needed some time and space to gather myself before it was my turn. I'd never been questioned by police before. I had no idea what to expect and just kept replaying scenes from TV shows and movies in my mind. Would they bully me, try to trick me? I had to stay alert. But Ford came out and joined me on the deck, sitting in the seat John had just vacated. He sighed and ran his hands through his hair. "That was fun," Ford said. "What did they ask you?" "They brought up my criminal record, of course, and wanted to know why I hadn't told Nick about it. They filled him in, and apparently he did not take it well." "That's the problem with keeping secrets," I remarked. "People feel stupid when they find out they've been deceived. It can lead to more problems than whatever you were trying to hide in the first place." "I know," Ford agreed. "But I doubt Nick and I would have stayed together if he knew about my past."
"I think you're underestimating him. He adores you."
"I know he does, but if he knew about my past, he'd have wondered if I was with him for him or for his money. Nick is already insecure about our relationship." "Because you're so much better looking than he is?" Ford blushed.
"That's not true."
"Yes, it is," I said. "And you know it." Ford shook his head, refusing to admit to it. "Why did you fall in love with Nick?"
I was genuinely curious. Nick had always seemed so shallow, so juvenile.
But then again, I'd only ever interacted with him when Esme was around. Maybe his sister brought out the worst in him. "He's probably the kindest person I've ever met," Ford said simply. "He has other great qualities. He's funny, thoughtful, a joy to be around. But it was his innate kindness that first got my attention. I haven't met many kind people in my life."
"Then why didn't you trust him with your secret?"
Ford sighed. "I've spent my whole life evaluating risks, when to take them, when to hold back. I thought it made more sense to not tell Nick than to risk being truthful and possibly losing him.
It wasn't like I was ever planning on committing another crime."
"You should probably go talk to him." Ford shook his head. "No, I'm going to give him some time. Between Esme and finding out about my past, that's a lot for Nick to process. Did the detectives tell you anything about the evidence? Whatever it is that's making them investigate her death as a homicide? They're not particularly forthcoming with details. They do ask a lot of questions, though." "What did they ask you about, other than your past?" "They wanted me to repeatedly go through what happened the night Esme died. All the details. I think they wanted to see if my story would stay consistent or if it was consistent with Nick's version of events."
"And was it?"
"I think so," Ford shrugged. "But they get you either way. If you mess up and you're inconsistent about something, some tiny detail anyone could have forgotten, you're lying. But if you tell the same story over and over without deviating, it's rehearsed."
"But I don't have anything to hide. I didn't kill Esme. And I know Nick didn't. We were together all night."
"What do you think happened?" Ford looked at me as though he were trying to decide whether to answer honestly. I waited for a few beats, but then he just shook his head. "I think we're all hoping the medical examiner will conclude her death was accidental," Ford finally said. But I hadn't asked him what he'd hoped. Ford was holding something back.
Suddenly, shouting erupted from inside. I turned to see John standing, his hands palmed down on the table. John's back was to us, so I couldn't see his expression, but I did have a view of the detectives, who looked satisfied. They'd wanted to provoke a reaction, I realized, and they succeeded. I could clearly hear my husband yell, "How dare you?" What did they ask him? I wondered. I only realized that I'd said the words out loud when Ford responded. "I think a lot of secrets are going to be exposed today," he said grimly. John's interview ended swiftly. Less than 20 minutes after it began, John stormed away from the detectives. He came out on the deck but didn't even look at me. Instead, he pushed open the gate and disappeared through it. His feet stomped heavily down the stairs that led to the beach. "John, what happened?" I called after him. No reply. "Do you have any idea what's going on?" I asked Ford.